My name is Ian Chavez, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues here at Dickinson College. I'm joined today by Matthew Turpin, a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution and former U.S. National Security Council Director for China. Matthew Turpin is visiting Dickinson College to deliver a Clark Forum program tonight titled U.S.-China Policy, How We Got Here and Where We're Headed. And he is joining me for an interview today. Welcome, Mr. Turpin.
Thank you so much, Ian. You know, it's a real pleasure to be up in Carlisle again. I come up on a fairly regular basis to come speak over at the Army War College, but it's my first time here on campus.
So our first question. Your career is quite expansive. Would you like to share a bit of your journey?
Yeah. I started, graduated high school in Southern California, decided to go to West Point, got accepted. I had never actually been to West Point. My parents put me on an airplane a couple of weeks after graduating, and I flew to the East Coast on my own, and I found myself in the Army. Not exactly what I had pictured it would be, but I had a great career. I did not study China or do China work at all as a student or anything like that, and really didn't start focusing on Asia and doing sort of Asia-Pacific work until I got to have an assignment in Hawaii, which if you ever get a chance to live in Hawaii, I would recommend you take that opportunity. It's a spectacular time. But since that time, about 15 years ago, I've been primarily focused on sort of U.S.-China policy and the dynamics there. Just as for the United States, this has become quite an interesting topic, and so I felt very lucky.
What advice do you, just more general, what advice would you have for students studying international studies?
Yeah, first of all, it's very hard to predict, as you're starting out, what will be the topics that are going to be of interest, and so it's really hard, I think, to pick that out. I would focus, sort of deeply on critical thinking, learning how to, write and communicate well. Figuring out how to do research is absolutely critical. And then being able to sort of write and communicate those ideas in a clear way. That really provides you sort of the basic building blocks to then be able to sort of pivot into, whatever the issues of the day are, which are going to change. Because if you're doing international relations, the world is continuously changing. Having to be a sort of aware of those things and have those basic skills is incredibly important.
Do you think the United States will be able to create a more consistent foreign policy doctrine in regards to the People's Republic of China amidst so much political polarization over the issue?
I mean, one of the top, I think the theme I'm going to have tonight is that the U.S. and the People's Republic of China have had a relationship since the founding of the People's Republic in 1949. So a little under 80 years of a relationship. And that relationship has gone through really four important transition points, and that U.S. policy towards China has changed as conditions have changed. And in many ways, if you'd have been looking at the sort of transition points, whether it was a change in, from China being an ally of the United States, before 1949, to being essentially an adversary that we're fighting a major war with by, the end of 1950, right? If you'd been sitting there in 1946 and like predicting the future, you would not have predicted the United States would be in a shooting war with China in just a few years. And so I think it's important to keep in mind that in many ways, our policies adapt and change as conditions change. I think it is incredibly important, to sort of, build off of the way you kind of brought this up in terms of sort of instability inside our own political system. I think it is very true that our policies often reflect those competing constituencies and interest groups and the weighing of various interests that we have as a country. To me, it's been pretty clear the United States is not monolithic, and neither is any other country. It has a competing, there are competing voices, there are competing interests, and that's what drives many of these things. But I think that there is there's sort of a broader through line of a rationale of what the United States is pursuing in its relationship. And that through line is independent of actual presidential administration. It really has a lot more to do with what's changing in China and then what's changing in the U.S.
Turning towards the economic side of the U.S.-China relationship, could you explain China's Belt and Road Initiative, and do you think it poses a real threat to U.S. interests and economic ties with countries across the globe?
Yeah, so the Belt and Road Initiative, you know, started around about 2014, you know, shortly after Xi Jinping came to power. You know, and in many ways, it's sort of a multifaceted policy. You know, one, it's a way for Beijing to have its own relationship with countries that are through its own economic connections. You know, in some ways, it was a way to be able to sort of offload excess infrastructure building capacity in China, just as China is beginning to sort of top out on the number of roads and bridges and office buildings that it can build. You still have a bunch of companies and a bunch of capacity inside China that is capable of building those things, and this becomes an outlet to be able to sort of provide those in other places, often along with loans to be able to then pay back to Chinese companies to perform the work. And so it's sort of a multifaceted strategy, but in many ways it's a strategy to sort of rewire the world, you know, to develop relationships and dependencies on Beijing, as opposed to what I think for China largely views as a world that has too many dependencies upon the United States, and a way to be able to sort of shift that balance in Beijing's favor. And so, you know, threat is a, it certainly poses a challenge to us in being able to maintain those kinds of relationships, particularly as the United States gets out of the business of providing aid or providing sort of infrastructure development financing, right, which we had sort of largely gotten out of over the years in many ways because it opens up, you know, all kinds of problems in dealing with corruption and other things that American companies kind of wanted to get out of that business. And really moving to a development model of providing development aid, you know, whether it's PEPFAR for, you know, combating AIDS in Africa, or it's sort of capacity building in terms of governance, much less physical infrastructure, much more on sort of the soft influence. And so that became a challenge. And I think, you know, we're still seeing that play out. You know, it is not as if this is an entirely a successful set of policies for Beijing either. You know, in many ways, the loans that they've given to build infrastructure have not resulted in sort of economically, you know, sustainable infrastructure that they've created, right? So, you know, ports that don't necessarily pay for themselves, or roads or bridges or other physical infrastructure that doesn't necessarily generate an economic return to be able to pay back the loans that China gave to those countries to be able to build the infrastructure, which places China in this difficult position. You know, some might view it as this was a sort of a nefarious plan all along, which was to entrap them, and there might be some aspects to that. But also there is a, you know, I think certainly Beijing would love to get paid back for their infrastructure. And in many cases, that's not happening, which is then, you know, forces Beijing to provide even more funding to cover those loans. And those countries are not happy that they're not getting the kind of economic returns that they thought they would. And so it's a bit of a mixed bag. It's not clear to me that the Belt and Road Initiative is a spectacular strategy, but it also does create real connections between countries, and there's a high degree of sort of corruption and abuse that goes along too, in which, you know, a chunk of money is provided to build a bridge or a port, and then an extra chunk of money to be able to provide to the finance minister or to the local governor, so that he can spread that money around to be able to sort of stay in power, right? And so that in many ways undermines the kind of good governance that many citizens, you know, are demanding. And it ties Beijing closely to sort of more leaders that are seen as corrupt. And it's not clear that in the long term that's a good strategy for Beijing.
Turning to the topic of Taiwan, in your opinion, do you think the U.S. policy of the strategic ambiguity surrounding whether or not we will come to the defense of Taiwan, do you think that's long-term? Do you think it will keep China at bay over the issue?
Yeah, so, I mean, I don't know if I think that strategic ambiguity has what has kept China at bay. Yeah, I think, first of all, I think we need to be very clear that, you know, the United States is not the only one with agency here. China makes its own decisions. It's not clear that this set of policies that the United States has had since really 1979, which would be to formally recognize and to prioritize its official diplomatic relationship with the PRC while maintaining a robust unofficial relationship with Taiwan and continuing to provide Taiwan with the arms and capabilities to be able to defend themselves. I mean, that's been sort of the U.S. policy. Strategic ambiguity, I think, you know, I think it's more accurately thought of as a sort of a messaging posture. What I just laid out was sort of the policy. The United States is going to both maintain its official relationship with Beijing and not take necessarily a position on the final disposition of the cross-strait dispute, although the United States is quite clear that we want a peaceful resolution of that in which both sides of the strait can come to an agreement, and that the United States will also continue to provide those arms and capabilities to Taiwan. But, you know, strategic ambiguity is that, for the most part, the United States will not speak publicly about what would a scenario look like in which they would intervene. Obviously, during the Biden administration, you know, on four separate occasions, President Biden actually did make that clear, right? He was asked hypothetical questions. And again, you know, he answered those things as hypothetical questions. If China attacked Taiwan, would the United States intervene militarily? And he answered that in the affirmative on those four occasions. And to me, that was much more of a shift in sort of messaging posture about how you're going to talk about it. It's not a secret that the United States, you know, has built out a military that is capable of responding to a military crisis in the Taiwan Strait. I mean, the United States has had a military posture to be able to do that for decades and decades. You know, the United States was fielding its most advanced fighter aircraft and naval ships to the Western Pacific all during the period of the global war on terrorism. That wasn't because we were worried about terrorists in the Philippines. It was really that there was an underlying reason of why you would field those weapon systems there. China knows that, and so does the United States. The United States chooses not to talk about that publicly. But and so I would sort of Beijing's the main reason why Beijing chooses not to invade is, I think right now they don't believe that they would win, and that is the main reason why they choose to delay their use of military force. I think they also think that they can use political warfare, influence, coercion, military threats, economic pressure to bring about a political capitulation on Taiwan and avoid a military conflict, right? So that is their preferred approach. But I think if Beijing believed that they could win decisively, then I suspect that Beijing would not be necessarily deterred by U.S. statements of whether it would intervene or not, right? It has much more to do with their own calculations of their likelihood of succeeding than of what the United States is saying or not saying.
So in the case of like a potential, if Beijing believed that they could take on the United States military, do you think, how do you think that conflict would play out? Do you think it would be more conventional based, you know, naval warfare?
So I think from Beijing's perspective, there could be a couple of hypotheticals here, right? Certainly one hypothetical is, you know, so right now I think Beijing believes the United States would intervene. They also believe, and I think this is new within the last, you know, 5 or 7 years, is they also believe that Japan would intervene militarily, right? And so when Beijing does the calculus of, again, countries go to war because they think they're going to win. They don't go to war because they think they're going to lose, right? So if you're the one initiating the conflict, you choose to initiate it when you think you have a possibility of winning, right? And so as Beijing looks at it right now, they see a Taiwan who they don't think is necessarily all that well prepared, but it's certainly prepared enough to not collapse in like the first few hours. They see the United States that appears prepared to be able to intervene, and likely, if Beijing were to do so in a particularly aggressive way, the United States would intervene militarily. At least that's what they believe. And they likely believe Japan would intervene militarily, right? And so they would have to say to themselves, do they think they can overcome that collection and to be able to win really a short, sharp conflict? So a drawn out military conflict. I mean, something that the Russians are going through now in Ukraine, where we're now sitting at, 3 years on, that's probably not a war that Beijing wants to necessarily initiate, to have a conflict stretch out for 3 years that essentially takes place off of the coast of all of their most important ports, right? So that's not a conflict that they would want to initiate that then stretches out for a long time. I think the reality is that if they think the U.S. intervenes, they then have to think through the full escalation of military conflict. I mean, two nuclear powers killing each other's soldiers and sailors and sinking each other's ships and shooting down each other's aircraft certainly could lead to nuclear escalation. And so Beijing, I think this is another reason why we see really an aggressive move to build out Chinese nuclear weapons, is that they don't want to be in a position where the United States possesses a clear superiority in nuclear weapons that can, from Beijing's perspective, that the U.S. can blackmail them into ending the conflict. And so they want to be able to match that. And so that, I think, from Beijing's perspective, they would have to think about the conflict all the way through the top level. And so if you had a scenario in which they did not think the United States would intervene and Japan would not intervene, then it's a much more limited conflict that Beijing is thinking about. But that's the real challenge for them, is that they don't actually know whether the United States would come in or not. Yet it appears that the U.S. is prepared to do so.
Going back to the economic side, do you think the Chinese economy or its military poses the greatest threat to the United States today?
So I'm gonna cheat here, and I'm gonna channel, I think, what Chinese leaders would talk about this. They would talk about what they would call comprehensive national power, right? That it's the combination of all those things. You know, it is the combination of 3+ decades of double-digit, you know, defense budget growth in terms of building out of their military and a modernization that, you know, since the late 1990s has been purposefully built to counter the United States, right? So, you know, the United States has built out a military force that takes in a variety of threats, and Beijing has been building a military force primarily built to be able to defeat the United States within the first island chain over a conflict on Taiwan. I mean, that's what military procurement, that's what most of what Beijing is building its military to do, is to do that mission. And so I think it'd be wise for us to take that very seriously, that if the second largest economy in the world and the world's largest manufacturer has spent 3 decades building a military to defeat you, you should probably take that seriously. And then I think we should also take very seriously the fact that, again, this is the second largest economy in the world and the world's largest manufacturer that is, you know, making enormous strides in areas of technology that 2 or 3 decades ago we did not think that they would be making major strides in. And so we have an industrial and a technological power that's tied to that military that is seeking to overturn, you know, many of the, you know, fundamental interests the United States has held for, you know, 8+ decades. And so that creates a multifaceted threat. You know, it is a country that has the designs and intentions to do things that undermine the United States, and it has the capabilities to do so. And therefore, those are things that you would have to take very seriously. And you really shouldn't be dividing one from the other, because they're certainly not dividing one from the other, right? It isn't as if they are saying we're only going to do things economically, or we're only going to do things militarily. They're going to combine those things to be able to achieve their ends.
Going off of that economic and military power, do you think our current policies towards China are working? And that with the past few administrations, we've had, you know, the CHIPS Act, we continue to do freedom of navigation operations and imposing tariffs. How effective do you think those policies are in combating China today?
Yeah, I mean, so at sort of the macro level, you're really starting from the end of the Obama administration and into the first Trump administration, we went through sort of a transition from a policy that we had held since early in the Clinton administration of viewing China as a potential economic and geopolitical partner, right, and that we would help the Chinese economy grow, become wealthier. with the expectation that what we would then see is the kind of political liberalization in which U.S. interests for how the world runs and Chinese interests for how the world runs would then align, right? That we would see a convergence between Washington and Beijing, and that convergence would come about through economic development leading to political liberalization, right? And I think, you know, certainly, you know, from my perspective, when I was sitting in positions, you know, in Washington at sort of the end of the Obama administration, you know, the debate was, you know, is this working? And I think increasingly the answer was, no, this is not working. And we're going to have to consider a new approach, right? And that Beijing, we've been certainly very successful in helping the Chinese economy develop and become economically, you know, wealthy and technologically advanced. We've done that really well, but the political liberalization part has not panned out and doesn't look like it's panning out. In fact, you know, it's moving in the other direction, right? And so this is sort of the thinking in 2015, 2016, and that we would need to adopt a policy of sort of strategic competition. And I think, to be perfectly honest, that is the path that we've been on since then. You know, are there changes and sort of tactical changes of CHIPS Act and, you know, tariffs and other things? Yes, but those are all within a category of viewing the relationship with Beijing through one of strategic competition and that Beijing is a rival and not a partner that is going to sort of share in the same geopolitical experiment as the United States, right? And so I think there's a common throughput there that we should keep in mind, even as administrations seek to distance themselves from each other in the rhetoric they use to talk about their policies. You know, when you squint your eyes a little bit, I think I see a lot more commonality than I see in differences.
And for our last question, with the rise of China, do you think the United States' time as the global hegemon is coming really to an end, and we're going to see the emergence of like bipolarity with China or a multipolar world?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think, you know, we should probably, you know, so I'm an American historian sort of by training. And so I think we should probably be maybe a little questioning of ourselves of, you know, what exactly was a unipolar moment and how unipolar was the world really? And how long did that really last? And if so, was that ever really sustainable? And so my sense is that, you know, we had a sense of unipolarity and a sense of consensus around, you know, a rules-based liberal international order in the 1990s. But we also had, you know, things like the wars in the Balkans. You know, when I was a young army captain, you know, the unit I first commanded, you know, had been one of the units that had been sent to Kosovo. And we were up against Russian paratroopers who were moving into Pristina. And, you know, in 1999, we were all quite concerned that the U.S. and Russia would be facing off in Kosovo as NATO was waging a war against Serbia. And the Russians were not particularly pleased with that and were coming in, right? And so I think we should think critically about this idea that sort of the U.S. is the only hegemon and has always been so, or has been so for three or four decades, that we do live in a multipolar world. In fact, we've always lived in a multipolar world. You know, even during the period of most bipolarity, heart of the Cold War, I mean, you have a non-aligned movement, right? You know, when the French leave NATO, it's military planning, you know, and Charles de Gaulle is kicking out on his own and challenging the United States for sort of leadership. You know, I mean, you know, there are many more, you know, as you look at it more sort of specifically, there are a bunch of other trends that are happening. You know, Japan follows, you know, a set of foreign policy approaches in the 70s and 80s that don't look like perfect matches to the United States. Certainly Germany and Ostpolitik, you know, opening up relations with the East in contravention to what the United States wants. These are the sort of trends that we were used to. We've in terms of shorthand, we've called these things a bipolar. But in many ways, we've always had this sort of multipolar aspect. And so, you know, to me, what's the biggest change is that, you know, for folks, you know, colloquially in the West, right? So, you know, the capitals of the United States, Canada and Europe, and Japan, you know, we've awoken from our vacation from history, right? That in many ways, what we had done is think that geopolitics didn't matter to me and it matter anymore, and that we would open up and create really a rules-based system in which countries would act as sort of referees or coaches on the sidelines, and then our companies would just sort of go out and compete in the international system, and we would get sort of the Ricardoian competition that's going on, in which countries that are best suited to produce one thing then trade with somebody who's best suited another thing, and you get this sort of perfect outcome. To me, that seems like that was simply never sustainable, in that nation states and nationalism, other things, have real plays in this, and that folks have a tendency to take advantage of the system. And that's what we're seeing, right? And so, you know, what the U.S. sought to construct didn't exactly work out as we had planned. And so we're now back into, we have to deal with a world that is divided and geopolitics matter. And so we now need to get to work on thinking about those things.
Well, that concludes our interview. On behalf of the Clark Forum, thank you again for sitting down with me to have this conversation.